From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made during a tour for prospective students at Colorado State University. The mother of a student called 911, saying she was concerned that two young men in the group were not meant to be part of the tour. She said they, quote, really stand out, and that their clothing had what she called weird symbolism. When the police arrived and took the prospective students aside, they explained that they had joined the tour late, having driven to Colorado from New Mexico. They said they were interested in possibly attending the university and were shy. The young men, who are Haudenosaunee, emptied their pockets and cooperated as police patted them down, and by the time police allowed them to rejoin the tour, it had left. So the students made the 7-hour drive back to New Mexico. This story caused outrage among Native communities. People across the nation noted similarities between this incident and others involving racial profiling, especially the arrest of two black men at Starbucks in Philadelphia who were just waiting for a friend. And it's just one example of racism displayed toward Native Americans. Two local groups are partnering to address this issue and to ask us broader questions. The Native American Cultural Center and Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice, are working together to educate the community about indigenous rights and history. And this hour, we'll discuss their goals. We're going to preview an upcoming event tomorrow where they're going to screen a film about Native American sovereignty at Standing Rock and related issues. And there's a lot to talk about this hour. I'd like to welcome our guests. Here with us is the director and producer of The Eagle and the Condor, which is showing tomorrow. More on that in a moment. It's Gaston Serra, Paulette Moore. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Oh, Nyawa. Thank you.
Ron Garrow is director of the Native American Cultural Center. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Kathy Castagna is a member of Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice, and lead facilitator of the Opening Doors Diversity Project. Kathy, welcome to you.
Thanks, Evan.
And
glad to be here.
Our guests have asked for a chance just to introduce themselves as well. And Paulette, I'm going to start with you.
Oh, thank you. So Nyawa means thank you. And Sego Sewa Gwego, Gastotora Yang Yats, Ganyage Haga, Niwa Kwenjoda, and Oswego Nikirerun. So that means my name is Gastotara'a Paulette Moore. I am Mohawk. I am Ganyangeha, and I live at Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve.
Thank you very much. Ron.
Sego Seguego, Lionlun Dio Unyats, Wagatsununi. I'm saying hello, everyone. My name's Ron. I'm happy to be here.
All right, Kathy.
Mi chiamo Kathy Castagna. Sono felice di essere qui oggi. I am a white Italian-American, born and raised in Rochester, New York, and reclaiming my language.
Nice to have all of you here. And I want to just make sure we understand a couple of things here. First of all, Ron, Kathy, and Paulette. And am I going to go with Paulette, or do you want me to say Gaston Serra'a?
Paulette is fine.
Okay,
yeah.
Whatever you prefer. Paulette, Ron, and Kathy are here because there is an event tomorrow, and if you don't know what the Native American Cultural Center of Rochester is, Ron's a good person to tell you a little bit about that. So, Ron, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about the center and its mission, and then we'll talk about the event tomorrow.
Sure. At the Native American Culture Center, we operate. It's a service organization, and just like WXXI, we operate through grants and donations. And what we do is essentially undo the effects of residential boarding schools. Rochester has a very large Native American population with many nations represented, and we provide services such as education, workforce development, language and culture. We have Native Woman Circle and Native American Sobriety. Essentially, we just try to undo the effects of residential boarding schools, and we provide all services, whatever it is that Native Americans need. And through a partnership, actually, with Surge, we're starting to become a Native Rights Center.
Yeah, so, Kathy, why don't you tell us a little bit more about what Surge is and then a little bit how this partnership is working.
Sure. Surge Rock is a chapter of a national organization of Surge, which began some years ago as a result of Ferguson and other consciousness around Black Lives Matter. And so the national has been asking for groups around our country to form chapters. And these chapters have certain values that we follow relative to the national organization. And our mission is to support the missions of people of color. So we don't take the leadership. We actually listen to people of color and their justice-led groups, and then we we come in to support whatever that is that they're looking for. So we have several campaigns, and one of them is to work with Ron and the Native American community in general in Rochester and to support various initiatives they have. But we're also doing other campaigns like Green Light for our indigenous, our Latino community. We're doing Police Accountability Board campaign. We're also working on the mass incarceration campaign. And so those are the kinds of things that we're involved with right now.
Okay. Well, the film is The Eagle and the Condor, Indigenous Prophecy Heals the Modern World. Ron, what's going on tomorrow that you want the community to know about?
Well, tomorrow we're showing the film. It's going to be at Prince Street, the Visual Studies Workshop, from 3 to 7. We're going to be serving some Indian tacos. I don't know if anybody out there has had any, or if you had any, then that's good stuff, though. And Paulette's going to premiere her, or pre-premiere, actually, her film, The Eagle and the Condor. It's an Indigenous prophecy, actually, I think I'll let her talk about more about what her film is.
It all starts at 3 o'clock tomorrow, right?
Yeah, the Visual Studies Workshop.
Visual Studies Workshop, that's on Prince Street in Rochester. So the Indian taco should probably be enough to get you there.
That's some good stuff.
Who's making them, by the way, Ron?
The Native American Women's Group.
Okay. And there's a $10 suggested donation if you attend tomorrow afternoon. So let's talk about the film and the related issues, and Paulette Moore is here to do that as the director and producer of The Eagle and the Condor. You started producing and creating this film when?
Really 2 years ago, when Standing Rock first happened. September of 2016, the dog attacks happened, and that was widely seen when Energy Transfer Partners, DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, dug up Native American graves, the graves of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation that had been identified that just the day before by the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, and they intentionally went and destroyed those graves, and it was just such an outrageous act. And so, and that was widely broadcast on Democracy Now. And so just soon after that, I went out and I made 3 trips that fall. I was there for the veterans that were there in December, and then 2 subsequent massive blizzards, and then went back in the spring of 2017 for one of the people that's featured in the film is the alderperson from Madison, Wisconsin, Rebecca Campbell. So went back for her pretrial, and then went back again in the fall. So 6 trips really altogether to Standing Rock. So it's been collecting a lot, visiting a lot of people, looking at the aftermath of what went on there.
There are a lot of threads that kind of tie together that we're going to talk about this hour. What's at the heart of what has happened in Standing Rock? Because as we've talked to our other guests on this program over the last couple of years, one of the common discussions we've had is whether treaties are truly honored and matter, or if they are just to be broken when it is convenient. And I don't know if that is at the core, at the top of it, if sovereignty is at the top of it. Is there a singular issue that stands out most to you from Standing Rock?
Certainly sovereignty is at the core of it. And 500 years, you know, on those plains, well, in our own Haudenosaunee context, but out on the plains, it's just this cycle of violence that keeps happening again and again, and the broken promises happening again and again, and the extraction from Native American energy and lands and families. So Standing Rock, and yet the thread is that we're all still here, you know? Native Americans still exist. And looking at that as a really key thread, and looking at ceremony as not something that's esoteric and that's elusive or, you know, sort of the noble Indian thing, but looking at ceremony as a practical guide for how all of us will survive. So that's really a core part, just looking at how people who were there, including Seneca Nation, plays a big part in this movie. People who were there and what ceremony means to them, and how Native American people have not lost this key connection. If you love the earth and you treat it as a relative, then you are going to protect it.
Paulette, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about how you view what has happened at Standing Rock in kind of the lens of what Surge is all about. Because as Kathy explained with Surge, the goal of Surge is not to I'm going to invoke a term that we discussed when it came to literature. Earlier this week, we discussed literature, et cetera. We talked about one of our guests brought up To Kill a Mockingbird and said, you know, modern classes should teach that as a white savior story, et cetera. And that, you know, Kathy made it clear that Surge is not aiming to be that, but instead to be a supporting organization that still elevates voices of color and communities of color. And I wonder, first of all, knowing that and sort of valuing that, how you view what has happened at Standing Rock, because I haven't been there, but a lot of the stories you read are certainly indigenous peoples from around the country showing up, but also people of all different backgrounds, and plenty of white people and people of color and all kinds of different backgrounds showing up. Is it still, is it appropriate? Is it showing up in support instead of sort of showing up to co-opt?
Exactly.
If that makes sense.
Right, that colonization can continue, and we've seen that happen in a lot of context where, bless their heart, you know, white people show up and want to take over and continue to speak to Native American people as if we don't have a beautiful history and a beautiful legacy of lawmaking and culture. So at Standing Rock, what we saw was a real, just that sovereignty and that ability to hold that space and to lead and to stand up, and then the amount of other nations that came in support. And I think what we saw were the indigenous nations coming and looking at each other and recognizing each other and being like, yeah, we do that too. We sing those songs. We share that worldview that the four-leggeds are our relatives and the water is our relative. Those are really important terms. Again, not esoteric, really specific. And so as far in the film itself, there are just marvelous examples of non-Native people who came to that context, who used their gifts, and the investigative reporter Will Parrish from The Intercept has done marvelous work in exposing the work of private mercenaries that were out at Standing Rock and their shaping of the narrative. So super important work where he has this ability and he has this access and then put it to use in service to the Native American context. But, I mean, that serves everybody. Saving the water serves everybody. And then Rebecca Campbell, who I mentioned, who's an alder person from Madison, Wisconsin, who got arrested as a legal observer on Indigenous Peoples Day in 2016, along with 26 other people. And her using that platform, she was out there to express solidarity. She took that message back to Madison, Wisconsin, and is also an independent journalist. So those are marvelous examples of people who come and use their power and their platform in service to this greater goal.
Yeah, and let me just ask Kathy a little bit about that, because it was your comments on Surge at the outset of this program that that kind of brought that idea into focus for me. And look, we've hosted and we will continue to host conversations about the way different parts of our community thread together and some of the challenges and what structural racism is and what privilege means and what advantage means. And sometimes when we have these discussions about activism, we hear people say, look, you want me to show up. You want me to support this. I show up and support this, and then you lecture me for being a white person supporting this, not doing it the right way. And, you know, I've heard that in many different conversations in many different contexts. And I'm sure you've heard it, too. What do you say to that?
I'm glad you said that, Evan, because what's been happening recently that is different than what's happened in the past is that it's really clear that white people need to be working with other white people to undo some of our attitudes, behaviors, all of those things that, you know, we absorbed living in a white supremacist culture. We just did. And it's not for purposes of blame. It's for purposes of undoing some of the ways in which we show up. So, for example, one of Surge's values is to call people in and not out. So we wouldn't be very good allies or creating allyship if we were just pushing white people away all the time. the same time, people of color need to express their frustration and all of those things, but they don't need to be our educators. We need to figure out how to educate. I mean, they could when they want to, of course, and they do. And at the same time, we need to be there to support other white people in making those changes. And Ron and I have actually talked a little bit about that in terms of, like, volunteers going to the Native American Cultural Center. And they're often white, and they're difficult, if I can speak for you, Ron.
That's my observation.
Well-meaning.
Well-meaning, right.
Yes. So, but tell me more about why difficult. What does difficult mean?
Well,
get right on your mic for me there, Ron.
Yeah, difficult means they show up and they really don't have the education, I guess. And I think it is that they're looking to be educated, and it seems like sometimes they come in there, they're more for themselves than they are for me, because they're seeking to get some cultural teachings rather than, and they say, they come under the premise that they're there to volunteer, and the whole time they're there to volunteer, they're asking for cultural teachings, and they're saying things that are disrespectful, like speaking about us in the past tense and calling us outdated terms where we're indigenous now, and they don't. And I said I'd rather that they got some sort of cultural sensitivity training before they volunteer at my organization, just so that we don't waste our time. And they take me away from my work, educating them about, and
sure, but
because that's not what we're for.
If you bring up the way that they are doing that in a way that is, as you say, maybe culturally insensitive, what's the response typically?
Well, I don't really get angry about it or anything. I mean, I'll answer their questions nicely, but I get frustrated by the end of the day, and I was, you know, I'll ask them not to come back, and it really isn't any of their fault. It's just, it's not, it's taking me away from my work when they're there to support me.
Sure. Okay. Good.
So being proactive about that and our partnership has helped to be intentional. So now Ron has sought out Surge to say, okay, if we're going to have volunteers, let's do some work with them ahead of time. So as white people, we can frame this in a way that says, look, we're all in this together. We've all made these mistakes. We're gonna, you know, it's another value in Surge. We make mistakes. We move on. We keep learning. You know, we can't all, you know, expect to know this. We were reared separately. We didn't know. We were given so much information that was inaccurate. And so now, a lot of us as white people just act that out. And it's not, like Ron said, maybe they're at fault. They're well-intentioned. And being intentional about doing some work ahead of time so that doesn't happen. So he doesn't have to be constantly doing the education when people show up.
Paulette?
And I think that what Ron said about referring to us in the past tense is a really key phrase, because there is this idea that it's a cartoon. It's not a fully rendered person that people think of when they think of Native American. Either it's romanticized or, the noble savage. There's so many different ways that people think that do not allow Native people to be fully here in the present with complex lives and just fully rendered individuals and nations.
Some of that is just the modern American public education system.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, I may have mentioned this before, but I think I'm going to say it many times, I suspect, as we have these kinds of conversations. As the parent of a young student, it's pretty remarkable when if you were to ask 5-, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds about, generally white, I'm talking about white kids now, what Native Americans are. They generally, often, and I've heard this multiple times in different groups and places, we'll talk about people who lived in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something, just listening to people like Ron, people like Peter Jemison and Michael Galban and some of the really important voices in our community, they echo in my head. And the first thing I try to do is to say, whoa, no. But there's a lot of immediately undoing at a very young age, and something that's very basic is erasing someone's even present existence. So just a good thing to remember.
And even as a filmmaker, I started out in mainstream media and working for Discovery Channel and Geographic and had my own ways of making television that did not honor our own people and did not honor a tribal context. And it took me, because that's a successful way of being. It's a successful lens. And so to bring my own filmmaking back to my own people and to this indigenous context has been a journey in itself of like, what does it mean to be an indigenous filmmaker? It means that we're showing the incredible humor of that context. We're showing the complexity, the strength, the resilience, and then these cultural practices that that create health in indigenous communities and then are offered as gifts outside of that.
Listeners, if you want to see the film, it's The Eagle and the Condor tomorrow, starting at 3 p.m. at the Visual Studies Workshop in Rochester. They're going to serve Indian tacos, just a $10 suggested donation, and you can meet Paulette and learn a lot more about these issues that we're discussing this hour. If you want to weigh in on anything you're hearing, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And let's go back to the film, but also let's tie it to the way reality is different than what we are taught or what sometimes popular culture gives us. And I'll give an example. Paulette mentioned that you go back just a few years ago when a lot of this was starting at Standing Rock and there was the digging up of graves, right?
Yeah.
In American popular culture, I'm just going to quote from the New Republic, October of 2017. They wrote a piece about, quote, the suburban horror of the Indian burial ground and the way it's caricaturized and basically turned into a cartoon in popular culture and how disrespectful. So this is, and credit producer Megan Mack for finding this, reading from the New Republic, quote, that a sensationalized portrayal of Native burial rites was woven into the mishmash of hogwash of the film Poltergeist in the 1980s, might not be entirely surprising. What is surprising, though, is how quickly the trope of a haunted Indian burial ground took root and spread throughout the rest of American culture. Haunted Indian burial grounds have appeared since Poltergeist 2, in Stanley Kubrick's adaptation of Stephen King's The Shining, and in countless lesser-known films, novels, and TV shows. It's a legend that's become so ubiquitous that it's become something of a cliché, showing up these days, as often as not, as a punchline in comedies appearing everywhere from South Park to Parks and Recreation, end
wow.
quote. And that's just one example of something that we either laugh at or we turn into, you know, the evil spirits that are going to come and steal your daughter, you know, in the suburbs if you accidentally build a house in the wrong place, as we saw in the film Poltergeist, versus the reality of the pain that happens for people when it actually is happening in practice, as we saw at Standing Rock. How do you contrast those things, Paula?
Well, and you actually see that in the movie. So one of the characters is named Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle, and she's a pediatrician. She's Dakota Sioux from Standing Rock. And when we asked her about, on this, you know, the September 3rd, the Dakota Access Pipeline workers jumped 20 miles because those graves had been identified the day before. They left where they were constructing the pipeline and went directly to the graves where her ancestors are buried. And so in the film, it's like you can't, she said it's so painful to even, it's re-traumatizing to even talk about it, you know, and you can see that in her face. And I think that's the importance of film, that it's not using that as an excuse. Like, you have to explain that your ancestors being dug up is traumatizing to you, but that's a moment that people do not see. So there's this I'm so glad Megan dug that article up, because that is such a prime example of how something that's so painful and so real, and anyone else who would have to see their ancestors dug up would just, it just wouldn't happen. I mean, it's just, it makes you crazy, you know, to have to watch these bulldozers go right over the grave, and the fact that they did it on purpose. And there's really no doubt about that, because they left where they were working to go destroy those graves. So time and again, and it's so useful to this overculture to treat that as a joke and to instantly jump on it and instantly depict these protesters and the water protectors as being goofballs and, you know, just go get a job, and the things that people say to people that go out, when what I saw is just incredible beauty, thought, and people who are focused on creating something, creation, not a death culture. There's a creation feeling and action there.
You're hearing Gesta Sara'a Paulette Moore, who is the director and producer of The Eagle and the Condor, which you can see tomorrow in Rochester at 3 p.m. at the Visual Studies Workshop in Rochester. Ron Garrow is director of the Native American Cultural Center, and Kathy Castagna is a member of Surge, showing up for racial justice and lead facilitator of the Opening Doors Diversity Project. We're going to get our only break of the hour now, and in just a moment, our discussion turns to a couple of questions for Paulette as a filmmaker. I'm curious to know exactly whom this film is made for and whom she's hoping the audience will be, and the impact when people who are not Native start to understand the connection to the earth that maybe, again, as she just said, we can make fun of the water protectors or we sort of cartoonize it. But when we try to understand it from their perspective, what do we gain? So we're going to talk about that after this short break right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Apple is finally responding to some pressure to make changes that would allow us to have more control over screen time for our kids. It'll also, perhaps, allow us to set boundaries for ourselves. Are you addicted to screens? Do you worry that kids are addicted to screen time? What is too much? How do you make that call? Local pediatricians help us guide that discussion next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for joining us on this Friday afternoon. All right, before we continue along that thread that I just talked about with Paulette, let me get a couple of listener emails in. First from Tim in Pittsford, who writes the following. He says, as a white person, I'd like to think I'm trying to help when I volunteer, but I'm not perfect. Coming in with a specific skill set and vast knowledge of Native people is going to be pretty tough. And honestly, when Ron says things like he asks people who are what I hope to be well-intentioned not to come back again, it really will make someone like me not to want to come back again, and that can't be good for either of us. So that's Tim in Pittsford offering some thoughts there. Let's, Kathy, you want to respond to that too? Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Tim. I hear you. I hear you feeling, from a place of like, wow, I feel really rejected here. In truth, we have to take risks. We have to listen. There's so many times when we ask people of color, what is it that you really need from us as white people? And the first thing is to just listen. And it's amazing how much that really matters, and it matters to us, because what we discover in our listening, that we have been harmed by racism, that we have learned things that are so untrue that it doesn't create authenticity in our relationships with people of color. So if we can see those acts as not rejection as much as information that will also help us to reclaim something in ourselves as white people. And I think to hear that Ron feels the frustration, he's tired, he's got a job to do, and to honor that and to know that with some re-education, he absolutely will welcome people in. Okay. And so I think it makes sense to hear that.
Fair, Ron?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to hurt anybody's feelings. And like I said, I know they're well-intentioned, but I think we need to attack this in a different direction. And like I said, with Kathy, I think we can come up with some training where I don't have to use my time that I'm trying to use to serve my Native American community into educating volunteers.
Okay. Here's an email from Mike who says, Evan, oh, come on. With the film Poltergeist, I thought the whole point of the evil spirits abducting the little girl was as a payback for something that developers never should have done, put a subdivision on an Indian burial ground. Why is that a bad theme? That's from Mike. Okay. I'm just going to tell you as a viewer, Mike, why does it have to be these horrifyingly, these evil spirits? Why is it, the beautiful, pure white girl who gets abducted by, Native spirits? I take the point. Don't build an Indian burial ground, but I'm not sure the execution of the actual danger and horror of the film doesn't do anything but caricature. But let me turn it over to Paulette for a response to Mike's email.
Well, and I think the point is that Dakota Access Pipeline didn't learn that lesson, and so many people haven't learned that lesson. And, a lot of our Mohawk brothers and sisters, back in the 90s had to do an occupation around similar issues. So those lessons are not learned because the thought does not go into it. It creates this situation where it's to be kind of laughed at, and it's not real. It's not real. If it actually did do what Mike said it did, we wouldn't be having these situations where this isn't even considered in people's mind that you're digging up people's relatives. So
yeah.
I think it did the opposite.
Mike, thanks for the email. And Chris in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, speaking as somebody with a European background, I think that the Europeans who came to North America basically are not able to live in the real world. In other words, they're not able to have a deep, sympathetic understanding of the natural world that they came upon. They have to take that world and commodify it to produce a highly artificial world, and in the process destroy the natural world. And I wish somebody would write about or make films about this basically insane way of approaching the world, because that's the source of the problem, the madness of approaching the world in that fashion.
Thank you for the phone call. Anything to add from our panel there? Paulette?
Madness is absolutely the right word for that. Thank you. I think it is at the core of the problem. I mentioned something called the death culture. You know, if you are not sympathetic, the great words that this caller brought, sympathetic. If you're not sympathetic to it, you will commodify it. If you do not look at the water as a relative, you don't care if it becomes contaminated. You know, but at some point that comes home for everybody. If the water gets contaminated, all of those people downstream are affected. The Native American people are stepping forward because they've never lost this connection.
We're talking to Paulette Moore, who is the director and producer of The Eagle and the Condor. And before the break, I said I wanted to find out from you, you made this film with any singular audience? What's the goal as a filmmaker?
It's actually, I'm glad you asked that question, because I've made now three main films about indigenous response to extractive industry. Two that were in northern Wisconsin, where the Ojibwe led a beautiful occupation on 5 acres of what would have been the world's largest open pit taconite mine on the shores of 10% of the world's fresh water. It was just beautiful because it was educational. They invited people in. They were in the forest, and they said, "Here, look, pick this leek, put it in your mouth. Now you're connected to the earth." Beautiful methods of education. That first film that I made up in northern Wisconsin, I really wanted the water protectors to see themselves in the context of these amazing things that they were doing and the global effects that they were having. And so I come from this mainstream media background, so bringing my gifts to this context of being able to link it to what else is going on in the world. So I would say also the films out at Standing Rock, I want to support the people who are there. I want them to see their stories knit into other people's stories so that they can receive that energy back. And then I also do want non-Native people to be able to see Indigenous people in this context. I want them to see how painful it is for Sarah to understand that the graves have been torn up. But I also want them to see the beauty of the Seneca Nation water protectors who are singing and who are so funny. You know, they're so awesome. You know, they like bring Wakanda, you know, it's just this beautiful world and this lightness that the Seneca Nation brought in this movie. So the complexity, I want people who are not Native to really understand the complexity of modern indigenousness.
And when it comes to the connection to the land that I think we can turn into a cliche, but many of us, people like me, white guys, grew up without a whole lot of background training and understanding of what Native culture really is about. What do you hope white audiences would take and understand about that connection to the land?
The way that I can explain the difference, so there are words like stewardship, that non-Native perspective. We are stewards over. There's always this positioning of being over the land, and that is really a colonial kind of dominant perspective. Everything else is there for my picking, right? From our perspective, Ron and I are Mohawk. Our main ceremony is called the Ohandu Garewadekwa. Every day we give thanks one by one by one to the bugs, to the water, to the people, to the trees, to the animals that give us food. We go one by one by one. And that changes your connections in your brain, because you develop that relationship, because you're reminded every single day that you don't lord over the bugs. You are in relationship to the bugs. And so it changes everything. It changes your relationship to other people. You know, I read a book recently by Stephen Ambrose about the Standing Rock Sioux and the, you know, coming of the settlers into the country. And, you know, the Native Americans were shocked when the people who came in, like especially in Ohio, they just tore all the trees down and then made fields. It's like the food is right there. The food, and we still believe, you know, the food and the medicines are in the forest. They're right there. Why would you expend all that energy, cut it all down, when it's there? Our world is full of abundance. You know, when you think in that way, that you are surrounded, it takes kind of the pressure off of you. Like, all I have to do is bring my gifts. And all we have to do as Mohawk, literally, is bring this gratitude. That is our main teaching, gratitude. And then that changes everything else.
Megan Mack, producer, remind me if we can remember, where did I have this conversation? It's driving me up the wall right now. I had this conversation recently, and I don't think it was on the air, and I don't even remember with whom, and now I'm feeling really guilty, because if that person is listening, I want you to tell me. But it was this moment where they said, look, Europeans used to laugh at this idea that some native cultures have, that, you know, the trees talk to each other, there's communication. Well, now we know that when one tree is diseased and dying, it releases pheromones, and right, other trees understand how to guard itself against possible disease and predators.
Absolutely.
And in many ways, they're actually talking to each other. Now we understand that better.
Right.
You don't remember? I don't remember. But anyway, that was an example for me. I went, wow, that's a great point of how we can sort of mock what we don't fully understand, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And if you accept that as truth that you are lording over and nobody else has communication or feelings, then you can dig it all up and contaminate it. I mean, if you start to allow that, I think that's why so much energy is expended in dissing, you know, indigenous ceremony and trying to, like, you know, change what it actually is because if you start thinking those thoughts, your whole system starts to break. You're going to have to change. You know, your whole system starts to break down because you're not lording over everything. And when we're in relationship, like we saw at Standing Rock, like the Lummi brought their salmon and the Menominee brought their trees, you know, like everybody who was an expert brought their things and were honored for that. And so all of these relationships that make things move along and help us survive.
Did you want to add to that, Kathy?
Yeah. What Paulette is saying is reminding me of my own journey as I'm continuing to undo racism and myself as a white person, and being invited by people of color to really reclaim myself and reclaim my culture. And when I did that, it was an opportunity to go back to something much more thriving. That some of us as Europeans have in our past. It's not just whiteness and privilege, but that we have cultures that did honor the land at some point. And when I went back to live in Sicily, I learned so much about the importance of land. Like, there was no greater gift than for a Sicilian family to invite you to their Campania and go out there and share the food that they grew. And you know, we came from an oppressed people as well, where we didn't get to have land. for a long time. We didn't get to have land until the 1900s and the mid-1900s, and then it just was considered very sacred. So it was more the way in which we as white people just succumbed to a kind of power over empire-building way that we came into our country and then began to adopt this worship of kind of money and power over what was really true, what we really had at our core and in our hearts, which was really to go back to those thriving places of our cultures. And that's part of our journey as white people. It is something that brings so much to us as we're in connection with people of color who are reminding us of that.
Ron Garrow, director of the Native American Cultural Center. You want to add to that, too?
Sure. At times, as the director at the Native American Cultural Center, I get environmentalist groups that call me and want me to come speak at their events and ask me to speak about the Native American viewpoint on environmentalism is, mm-hmm. and I say, you know, it's pretty easy. You just show appreciation and don't pollute the water, don't kill all the animals, don't cut down all the trees. I'm not sure, you know, when you show appreciation the way that we do in our community and Native American tradition, you know, it becomes pretty evident that you don't do that and the world will be a better place.
All right, I see the phone ringing, and let me get a couple of more emails here, because on that subject, Neely Kelly emails us. She's a senior organizer for a group called Mothers Out Front, and she Neely writes, Evan, intersectionality of climate justice and racial justice is a big buzzword these days in the climate movement. Listening, learning, and better understanding the harm done to Native and Indigenous peoples by the fossil fuel industry is critical for all in the climate movement, especially if we are going to support communities that have been harmed. For that reason, it is important that climate activists in the Rochester area prioritize attending this event tomorrow. I encourage you to show up, listen, and learn. Opportunities like this do not happen every day. Paulette and Ron, thank you so much for bringing this opportunity to us. That's from Neely with a group called Mothers Out Front.
Yawa, Neely.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
You're saying thank you?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. Thank you.
And just generally speaking, you want to build off what Ron had to say about understanding, you know, sort of the Native perspective on what climate justice might mean and our contribution to that, Paulette?
Yes. Well, especially when you see the violence that comes, you know, and with Neely talking about the fossil fuel industry as well, and the tactics that are being used in order to dismantle and dismiss any kind of appreciation. You know, it's like, that's for chumps, right? You know, it's like, oh, but don't be so naive. Don't be so, you know, oh, your tree is your relative, you know, and it really is. If I can go outside my door and harvest a plantain, which is a weed that everybody really wants to get rid of, that is so full of medicine, it's kind of mind-boggling. And even dandelions, you know? And it is as simple as that. It is these small, attention to these small details, these things that we try to kill are so full of abundance. And when especially that intersectionality, when you look at a, you know, this dandelion is something that you must kill. And I've been going by neighborhoods where they say, you know, like this is a bug-free zone because of the chemicals that they've put on the ground. Mm. It's like, what? You know, the bugs are so important, you know, and we've killed the bees, you know, already. These things, when you don't think them through and you just don't want to get a mosquito bite when you're out sitting on your lawn, that is such a short-term worldview. And the Indigenous perspective is 7 generations. And I had a really palpable feeling when I was interviewing one of the Ojibwe elders for the film From Wisconsin with Love. He talked about his great-great-grandfather making a treaty that would ensure that he could still go harvest the land. And I just felt like his ancestor was in the room. Like, he loved him so much. That is this word love. You know, think about how much love it takes to think down the line to Joe Rose, my great-great-grandson, and under great duress, create a treaty that will protect him.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the recent story I saw. It was the headline, and I don't remember what publication, but the headline was, "That spider in the corner of your bedroom isn't likely to bite you and is actually doing more to help." And somebody on Twitter wrote, "Did a spider write this article?" And we were laughing about that. But certainly, beyond just laughing at that little joke, you know, the sort of the interconnectivity of everything is something that we have been good at not having to think about. If we want to just gas the bugs out of our yard, we can.
Right.
If we want to have a monoculture of a lawn, we can. And there's a cultural prize for having a really good monoculture lawn out there.
Oh, absolutely. People think you're crazy if you start to harvest the weeds, right?
Yeah. Before I jump back to your phone calls, real quick, Ron.
Yeah, one of the teachings that I share with people, and they're, you know, mosquitoes get a bad name, but I've shared this with some people, that the purpose of the mosquito is to guard the forest.
There you go.
The mosquitoes to guard the forest?
Yeah, that's the role they play.
Okay, so if I could just ask, because this will, Ron, you're going to answer a big question I've had. I mm-hmm. grew up steeped in Ogden Nash, the great American poet who wrote a poem. He has a whole zoo. He writes about animals, and he wrote, "God in his wisdom created the fly and then forgot to tell us why." That's the mm-hmm. one that I know. Do we know if the fly has a purpose? If the mosquito, okay.
Mm-hmm. He's a decomposer, isn't he?
Oh, see? Mm-hmm. Even the fly.
And even the mosquito.
Especially the culture we have growing up is just to kill whatever we can.
No, not my culture.
Well, no. I'm speaking from me.
You said our.
Good point. Yeah. I'm speaking mm-hmm. from me. Let me grab Paola on the phone. Go ahead, Paola.
Hello. Yes. Hi. Thank you. Evan, you were just saying that you don't remember when you were hearing this idea of the interconnectedness between humans and all beings. And so we were in the program a few time ago with Patricia Walinga that came from Ecuador, from the Sarayaku community in the Amazon. And so she was telling us about the living forest and how interconnected is their culture, and especially in the jungle where, you know, even the language, they say, like, the bird told me that it's going to rain, or I know that, for example, there's when they are hunting and for some reason they kill the mother of a monkey, for example, it's been known that the mother of the family in the town takes care of the baby monkey and even breastfeed the baby monkey. So there's a very important relationship there. And also I wanted to say that so I do work with farm workers here in the Rochester area, and we're going to host a harvest festival on September 9th, which really is to bring that connection back to the earth, to Mother Earth, from the people that harvest and plant our food as well, that normally come from indigenous cultures as well, but are totally forgotten when they come and work here in, like, conventional facilities. So,
Paola, muchas gracias. Thank you for that, helping revive my memory, which fails too often over 500 hours of live radio a year. Thank you, Paola, for that. We're down to our last couple of minutes, and if you're just joining us late in the hour, you got a chance tomorrow to see The Eagle and the Condor, and the producer and director of that film is Gaston Sara Paulette Moore, who is here with us, giving us a sense of what the impact that this film could have for different audiences. And now I want to ask you, we didn't talk much about politics, about the White House and what's going on now, but how do you see the current climate out at Standing Rock, where you've been many times?
The climate at Standing Rock?
Yeah, vis-a-vis the politics and who's in power.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the last administration failed us as well. They could have done something to stop that pipeline, and they did not. So I think that there is a whole system of people that continue to ignore this. In Canada, Justin Trudeau has just promised to bail out a pipeline at the incredible cost of, you know, $4 billion when our communities there are, and he's supposed to be the climate guy, right? So there's something amiss. There's something that's out of balance. And I think that restoring that balance, doing the hard, very careful and abundant, wonderful work of restoring balance in our own lives. I mean, do you really? I feel like, you know, Ron's amazing work deals with the residential schools, taking people away from their culture. I feel like our whole culture does that now. You know, people are, have to be at work all day. And if they do anything that's fun or just jaw-jacking with their friends, you know, it's like, don't you have a job? Aren't you important? You know, and so restoring balance is huge. And I think that through ceremony and just these examples, you don't have to do ceremony. You can do art. You can do something different.
A lot to learn, and tomorrow, 3 p.m., you can see the film. It's at the Visual Studies Workshop. That's on Prince Street in Rochester. They're going to be serving Indian tacos, and you can meet Paulette and have a conversation about The Eagle and the Condor, Indigenous Prophecy Heals the Modern World. Just a $10 suggested donation tomorrow. Paulette, thank you for your time, the insight, and hope to talk to you again. Thank you. Thanks to Ron Garrow from the Native American Cultural Center. Thank you very much to Kathy Castagna from Surge. Thank you, Kathy. Short break. More connections coming up.